I'm Jared Kimber, and welcome to Wagon Wheel. This is the cricket podcast where we answer questions from you, the person who's asked the questions, unless you haven't asked a question. The best way to do it, of course, is via Patreon. You can subscribe there and... went too early then. You can subscribe over there at first class level and above and ask your questions every week. Or you can hang out on the live on YouTube. And if you do a super chat, I'll certainly add those in. But also anything else that takes my fancy, I'll certainly have a look at as well. So big thanks to everyone again for showing up in the live. But let's start with the Patreon people. And we've got Vikas, who says, what happened with Gary Balance? He made his comeback earlier this year for Zimbabwe, scored a century or two, and then retired suddenly. Was it because he wasn't liked in the dressing room? Look, there's a lot of rumours, and I think by now we were kind of expecting them to be more confirmed. I think there were some things about the racism trial in Yorkshire that were also causing issues. I mean, it was a weird fit, right? A guy who had essentially left English cricket for racism going to Zimbabwe, with their history. So I would assume that it was something towards those lines, but there was also some other issues with his some private circumstances, I suppose. As I said, they are rumours, so I don't want to go into them too much, but that, you know, he wasn't doing particularly well. As far as I'm aware, it was nothing to do with, like, the players didn't accept him when he came in or anything like that. I'm sure there were issues based on what had happened with Yorkshire and everything else, but I don't think that was the overall reason. I think it was more to do with some personal stuff that he had and perhaps the history. I think it's, to be fair to him, it's probably been a big couple of years, right? And he made a rash move, because I think that's the wrong way of putting it, but he made a big move, to go back home to Zimbabwe, and maybe it didn't go the way that he was hoping. Bloody says, I listened to the Final Words Calling the Shots documentary recently. Why was the ECB so hostile to Test match so far? The stump mic feed was not used, so don't understand why they cared so much. So for those who don't understand, Test match so far was one of the earliest sort of online sports commentary services, which it's now Guerrilla Cricket, essentially, with, you know, some of the cast change, but very, you know, some of the original people from Test match so far are involved with Guerrilla Cricket at the moment. There's a bit of a loophole when it comes to commentating on sports of, like, radio companies obviously spend a lot of money on the rights, but essentially what they're paying for is access to the ground and the ability to get the sounds of the ground. There isn't really a law that in many countries that forbids you from actually broadcasting at home. And when the technology caught up, people like Test Match Sofa and Whiteline Wireless as well in Australia in cricket. There was one in India as well that did the IPL for a little while. Kind of like watch-alongs, really, but Test Match Sofa was very much a ball-by-ball commentary service, and that was one of the issues. So the ECB are trying to sell their rights, and there's someone else doing it for free. That was what the issue was. It's interesting because, you know, all these years later, guerrilla cricket is not like a massive endeavor, right? Like, it hasn't taken market from the BBC. I'm sure it has at times, you know, there are some people who probably just prefer it or Test Match Sofa when it originally existed. But I think the thought process back then was that these people were doing it for free and cricket wasn't making any money. But if we're being honest, the BBC were obviously the most upset. There were, you know, a few key people at the ECB very upset about it, but it was legal. And that was the kind of the issue. But there are other ways that they could blackball, you know, people who worked on Test Match Sofa were at danger of not getting accreditation. And, you know, for someone like me who was a journalist, that was quite a big deal at the time when I was doing Test Match Sofa. And, you know, just other things too, like, you know, there were sponsors that wanted to sponsor, but then they were like, well, wait a minute, why would we... they were being encouraged not to sponsor a pirate cricket commentary thing. But yeah, there's a lot of big egos. There's a lot of nonsense about cricket radio rights. I still don't understand why cricket radio rights are exclusive. I don't think that helps cricket at all. And I've been on the record of that for about 12, 15 years now. It was a really, really interesting thing. The funny thing is now we do have watch-alongs. The only board I know these days who was upset about it was the BCCI. They were quite upset about it. And I think there might be a law in India that makes it a little bit trickier than other places, from my memory. But around the world, you could pretty much set one up yourselves if you wanted to. It's really just up to you to make it good and get people across. And that's, to be fair, that was the secret that Test Match Sofa had is that they really thought about what Test Match Special was and they went for something different. And then they advertised directly to expats who couldn't listen to the BBC's broadcast outside of the UK, which again, just very smart little things. And Guerrilla Cricket, again, very big with expats. Ali says, has Australian crowds generally gotten friendlier? Used to hear a lot from back in the days, the Australian public would jeer at the opponents quite a lot. Mohammed Siraj might disagree. Look, it's a lot different than when I grew up, for sure. The 90s were pretty toxic at the MCG. I would even say when I started my career, the Gabba was still quite full on at times. Don't know if the others are as bad anyway. I think those were probably, you know, in modern days, the two most famous ones. But Australia's changed as a society now as well. I think I went to the game with the record number of ejections at the MCG. It's just, it was a horrible, horrible thing. Just like, you know, I've talked about it before, you know, the people throwing cups of piss up in the air, and every time a woman walked, she'd be sexually harassed, and you know, homophobic chants at players, and you know, all sorts of things like that. Like it, and I'm just talking about the MCG, you know. But Ian O'Brien talked about being called homophobic slurs at the Gabba, and Cricket Australia didn't believe him. They just wouldn't get away with that now, right? Like, things have changed so much in such a quick amount of time. And, you know, as sports become more professional, it's just harder to allow for those sorts of things to happen. Premier League football is another perfect example of something that had to ship up, right? You know, these things, you can't keep just letting these things go untreated, especially now that athletes have a voice. You know, Cricket Australia was quite embarrassed by the Ian O'Brien. Ian O'Brien had like a personal blog. They were quite embarrassed by that. And imagine what would have happened even 2 or 3 years later when he was on Twitter and everything else. Like, it would have been an even bigger deal by that point. So, as Twitter got bigger anyway. So, yeah, it's very much a normal thing that we'll see. And, you know, not all sporting crowds do that. And sometimes the opposite is encouraged. But I've always thought that, like, eventually you get to a point where financially people don't want to be associated with that kind of brand, right? And that's essentially what sports come down to. Rucha says, over the past 10 years, who are the best defensive test pacers? I would say Anderson, Ishant, Abbas, and Philander would be up there. That's a very, very good question. I haven't really thought about that. I mean, for me, taking wickets is the most important thing, obviously, that I'm looking for, especially in a situation like Test cricket. Not that there aren't defensive times that you should bowl or anything like that, but just as a general rule, like, I don't really care how defensive you are or how attacking you are, as long as you're taking wickets. There are team tactics. I always remember Steve Finn. I had no problem with him as a bowler, but it didn't really suit the way that the rest of the England team was bowling. And we saw Mitchell Johnson have issues with the Australian team at times. But generally, you know, just get wickets. You know, that's a really cool thing to have happen. Is wickets. You should always go for wickets, that sort of thing. But let's have a look. Last 10 years, let us have a look at, I don't know, a minimum of 100 wickets for fun and see what I can come up with. Where are we? Economy rates. So Jimmy Anderson has the lowest economy, 2.45. Jason Holder at 2.57. You mentioned Vernon Philander, he's at 2.58. Bumrah is surprisingly high at 2.71. I know he's not easy to score off, but he does kind of attack a little bit more. Ishant Sharma's up closer to 3. I forget the other one that you mentioned now, sorry. Rujo, who's the other one you mentioned? Oh, Abbas. Abbas might not have enough wickets for the metric that I had looked at. Yeah, generally it's just going to be accurate bowlers. And I think you can see Holder, Bumrah, Hazelwood all up there as well. So, and Broad. So there's a few taller bowlers as well. Those are all the guys that are under, what are those guys all under? 2.9, let's say, economy. But Anderson and Philander are still very much there. So accuracy and or height are the two things that are hardest. Mitchell Starc is the most expensive, 3.41. Shannon Gabriel's less expensive than Mitchell Starc. I wouldn't have had that on my thing. So yeah, there's, you know, a big difference at the other end where you have Rabada and Shammy and Mark Wood and those sorts of guys. Neil Wagner is another one who's a little bit more expensive. So I think that follows. Anderson gets a little bit of a boost too, just because he probably bowled on slightly better wickets. Although, to be fair, Holder bowled on some bad some wickets that was hard to score on. Saranga Lakmal is up there too. I think those are the ones that make sense, but it's not something I factor in all that much, unless it's kind of if you're a fourth bowler or a fifth bowler, that's when I start to look at economy. You know, let's say you might average 38, but you might be going at, you know, 2.5 runs and over. Then you're just like, well, yeah, they're not getting wickets, but you're not getting away from them. And they're helping build pressure just in a different way. Richard said, what made Yasir Shah so good in England, but so bad in Australia? How much of that, I would assume, is just when he played in those different places? Is that a potential? But, I mean, in England, he averaged, I wanted to say 40, 38. That's not too bad, my memory. And he averaged 89 in Australia. He played in Australia over two periods. Played in England. I played in England over two periods as well. I wonder what the breakdown of him in England is over the two different places. Let's have a look here. So he takes a lot of wickets in 2016. So that was the tournament. And then in 2020, I got 8 wickets at Old Trafford as well. I just quickly have a look at the Australian ones as well. So he played 3 tests, 2016, 2017. Then another test in 2019. 2 tests in 2019 in Australia. He just never took any wickets, did he? Took a 4-wicket haul at Brisbane. That was a day-nighter, I think. I think I was at that game. Was that a day-nighter? No. Okay, no, that was 2019. That was later. What makes him different? Yeah, I don't know. He's a baffling bowler, Yasir Shah, because his record overall. So I was going through this the other day. So he averages 26 his first year, 23, 38, 28, 23. Then he averages 101, 35, 37, and 39. That 101 is probably mostly in Australia. But he did play in Australia while he was a fairly good bowler as well. I can't think of anything technically why he shouldn't be able to bowl well. I always thought technically he held up. My guess is he probably didn't put a lot of overspin on the ball though. I didn't think he put a massive amount of revs on the ball, whether it be side spin or overspin. And I think in Australia you probably need to, you know, rely a little bit more on bounce. And the overspin and bringing in other factors. So that would be my guess. Why it worked in England? I mean, my memory of him bowling in England is that he very much attacked the stumps and went about it in that kind of way. I also remember one really bad spell that I want to say in 2016 in Australia where he was used to bowl leg spin down outside leg stump. I think it was against Renshaw or something, or Warner. It's absolutely pathetic and really, really stuffed him over. My guess is that it would be a overspin issue, but I haven't seen him bowl in a little while. I'd have to go back and have another look. GD says, how would you compare Dennis Lilley and Richard Hadlee? Besides the stats, Lilley had Tomo as a partner for a lot of his career, but had to fight injuries. Hadlee was probably slower, definitely in the beginning. Well, Hadlee was really quick in the beginning, GD. I don't know if you know that. And he reshaped his bowling based on Lilley, right? Like, so in some ways we wouldn't have had Hadlee if it wasn't for Lilley. And I think, I can't remember who it was, but it was one of the New Zealand senior players who basically took him aside and said, look, you're never going to be fast enough to blast through the Australians consistently. You need to find other skills. And, you know, and at that stage, Hadlee sort of, you know, looked into Lilley and followed that style. So, I think that was fair. I think if you did a really advanced search, you would have to say that Hadlee probably bowled on much better wickets. I don't think you can really compare the two. You know, Australian wickets are a bit more of a slog, whereas Hadley could probably come on at any time and you know, get some kind of assistance in New Zealand, especially in that era. I haven't done the full breakdown of Hadley's career, but I have had a look at New Zealand batters. There's no doubt that their wickets were hard to score on at that point. So that's a huge advantage to Hadley. Hadley played in Asia and had a decent record in Asia. I'm trying to, where are we? In Asia, 13 test matches, average of 21.58, right? And that split with six matches in India, an average of 22, three tests in Pakistan where he averaged 44, and four tests in Sri Lanka where he averaged 12. That was very early Sri Lanka. So if you take that out, he's still averaging what? High 20s, maybe low 30s across India and Pakistan. Whereas Lilly doesn't really play in Asia, right? Like it's, you know, at that period of Australian cricket, he didn't play. I think there was a tour where he might have been off of World Series cricket as well, if I remember. So we don't really know how well Lilly would have gone. All we know is that in Pakistan, he averaged 101 in three tests, which is not particularly good, but that's all we have. He played one test in Sri Lanka, didn't he? He averaged 35 in that one test. So again, it's only four tests. I'd have to go back and have a look at the wickets and everything else. My guess is that the ability of Lilly to combine with pace with everything else he did would have made him a better bowler than Hadley. But I think when Hadley actually copied Lilly, he became a better version of that kind of bowler than even Lilly was. But I don't think there's as much in it as perhaps their overall bowling averages suggest, just based on what I said before of the pitches. So Hadley averages 22.29 and Lilly averages 23.92. That's probably a little bit closer, but I think that, you know, Hadley had, what, a 17-year pro career? And Lilly had a 13-year pro career. So if you factor in that extra time, if you want to put the batting in as well, I don't think he was a particularly good batter, Hadley. At least one of his hundreds was gifted to him because the West Indies were doing a dirty protest on the ground. But he could certainly hold a bat and was a better bat than Lilly was. I just think Hadley probably still marginally is better, but I would have to have a look at the wickets, and you'd almost have to have a look at the how well Lilly did against overseas players in Australia compared to how well Hadley did against overseas players in New Zealand. They're all overseas, but you know what I mean? You'd have to factor out the home records because Australian batters warp the home records a little bit. And to see what kind of records these players had outside of themselves, outside of those bowlers, if you take that out. So one thing that was interesting is that Hadley, for all of his success, averaged 25 in England. And yet he, you know, as we know in county cricket, was an absolute star. And Lilly averaged 20 in England. That kind of goes against the kinds of bowlers we think they both were. And if you want to go up against the best batting lineup that those two would have gone up against would have been the West Indies. Hadley averages 22 and Lilly's up at 27. So struggled a little bit more with the West Indies. I don't think there's a massive amount in it. But the truth is that Hadley doesn't exist without Lilly, but that doesn't mean that Hadley doesn't become a better bowler than Lilly. Simon Nathan says, I started watching cricket in 1998. Do you concur with my lineup of the greatest underachievers since that time? Nathan Hastell, Michael Vaughan. I think Michael Vaughan was an overachiever. Sean Marsh. Sure. KL Rahul. Maybe in Test cricket. This is Test cricket, is it? I think perhaps in Test cricket. Mamudullah. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know about Mamudullah. Irfan Pathan. No, I think they got the most out of him. You got Keith Miller here, but spell Keith Miller wrong. Is there another Keith Miller I'm missing? Is it Millier? And I'm reading it wrong. I'm not sure there. Matthew Hoggard. I think the thing with Matthew Hoggard is, and I've said this before, at a certain point in his, when he retired, he had a very similar record to Jimmy Anderson did at a very similar age, and wasn't quite, didn't quite look after his body, or didn't have the same kind of body as Jimmy Anderson, so couldn't bowl on forever and maybe cash in. I think Hoggard pretty much got the most out of his potential when he played. Kemar Roach would have been a great, but was in a car accident, I think. And he's gone on to have a fantastic career anyway. So, you know, Muhammad Asif, I mean, definitely Muhammad Asif, just because of everything. And then you've got substitutes of Mahela J. Wardner, Imran Nazir, and Simon Jones. Imran Nazir I would definitely have on that list. Mahela J. Wardner, I mean, wasn't a good player of pace, we'll see. And if he gets himself to a slightly above average player of pace, he's probably quite easily in the top 30 batters of all time. But he also makes like 9,000 runs in Asia and only makes like 2,000 or 3,000 outside of Asia. It's not just that he didn't get as many opportunities as some other players. Simon Jones was injury. Nathan Astle is really interesting. I'm not sure Nathan Astle was any better than what we saw him to be. I'm trying to think of other players who, you know, Adrian Bharath is probably one. What's his name? The Indian Vinod Kambli is certainly another one. I mean, you know, Shane Watson certainly should have been a better player all round than he probably was. You could probably say the same of Freddie Flintoff, despite his impact. Trying to think of some other players. Ian Bishop, obviously, again, injury related there. I'm trying to think of others from the 2000s. Yeah. I mean, those are the ones that instantly come to mind. Dilshan, maybe another one, who, when he finally worked it out, was absolutely fantastic. I'm not sure. All right, let's take a quick break. And after the break, I'll come back and finish the Patreon questions. I'm Jared Kimber, and this is The Wagon Wheel. Thanks to the kind folks at FlexiSpot for looking after my office and my butt by sending me their E7 Pro desk that save your favorite desk heights at a touch of a button. You don't have to crank anything. This thing just finds the height that you like and you can work. And their BS12 Pro chair that supports my posterior while I'm recording, well, this ad and all my shows. If you need great desks, especially ones that change heights or the best quality chairs, head on over to FlexiSpot.
Do you make content but don't want to listen to yourself talk? Well, I get that. Memento FM's AI does all the listening for you. It picks out the highlights and it makes you sound far more amazing than you really are. Embrace Memento FM today.
Ben says, India have toured South Africa twice in the last few years. For a nation to play more tests, make more money from tests, is the best way to do all they can to invite IPL ownership into their domestic league. Oh, no, I don't think those two things are related at all. I'd be very, very surprised if that was the case. So no, I don't think it's the SA20 league that has done that. I mean, it can be a bit random, depending on who you suck up to and who's available at the right time and everything else. Like, I don't think there's any one way to ensure that India play you other than the fact of being Australia or England helps, because they can make in India, they can make more money when you two are over there. Ben says, there must be more optimal material to try to cricket ball than White's material. Well, not all whites are the same. Why don't teams pay a scientist to find out what it is? Dye it white and then put a patch on the sleeve and the thigh of their team's whites. Well, England did this. England had one of those, about a decade ago? I think they're the only team that I'm aware of, although I think there has been some tests with different kinds of material in cricket shirts and everything else to be able to do it. I don't know if a scientist was involved or just players doing it themselves. But yeah, England used to have a patch on their trousers to shine the ball. It seems to have gone away. I would say that perhaps it didn't work. And I don't know how much testing went into it beforehand. William says, if every country had to pick a test 11 for players that don't feature in their premier white ball tournament, a la South Africa, who would have the strongest team? You could argue it would be Australia, because the vast majority of their players don't play any Big Bash. It's a really hard one to answer, because you're asking me, William, to try and factor in all the different 11s of 12 different teams off the top of my head. My guess is it would be the team with the strongest red ball bowling that doesn't play white ball cricket. So if for whatever reason you had two or three gun quicks and a really good spinner who didn't play in your major competition, then that would be the team that would have the most chance of winning. Because usually when you get to second and even have a look at, the Australia A back in the day, they started, they had Rifle and Merv Hughes, and then there was a bit of a drop off with the bowlers. And that's generally the problem, right? Is finding, it's hard enough to find five decent bowlers or seven decent bowlers at any one time. When you have your A team available, then you're trying to find two lots of bowlers. And then in this case, you're talking about perhaps your 25th best bowler, right? Like it might be a situation like that. So whoever has the best bowlers would be the case. It might be England just because they have more first class cricketers. It might be Australia depending on how you count being available for that squad. Most of India's best players are probably in the IPL one way or another now. Most of Pakistan's best players, so most of the best players in the world would be available. William says, what's the best cricketing moment you have missed while having a dump? So there's an old episode of Aaron Sorkin's TV show, what was it called? Sports Night? And there's a whole thing about some fantastic play happening in baseball and the writer missing it because he's in the toilet. I couldn't even tell you in cricket. So I always thought that was a really interesting one because, baseball obviously goes for 3 or 4 hours, but in cricket, you're there for 7 or 8 hours. Chances are you're going to go to the toilet during the play. And I've probably done it so many times and missed so many things. I can't think of anything consequential I've missed, but I'm sure I have. I'm sure I've missed a great catch or a great delivery or, an over at certain times. But in cricket it is, an average day for most cricket journalists, broadcasters is probably 10 hours, maybe 11 hours in some cases. You got to go and you got to go, right? And also, depending on the ground and everything else, sometimes it's not going at the drinks break or going at the change of innings. Sometimes the toilets are full and everything else. All these things happen. I remember the Whacker used to have one toilet. Right, so there's no way you couldn't miss cricket at the Whacker, and there's a couple of other grounds with really really small toilets. So the Oval famously has 2 cubicles. So if you get one person who hasn't been eating their muesli, there's a line, right? And if you want to go with the fans, you've got in most countries in most sporting stadiums in the world, you've got piss all over the floor. You've got in the Western stadiums, you've got drunks. In some of the stadiums, there's no toilet paper by the time you go in and everything else, as we all know as cricket fans. So you kind of have to wait for the staff ones. So yeah, I'm sure I've missed stuff, William, but yeah, I don't keep a log, so to speak. Ian says, HS Patel's name popping up in the Cricket Spinners episode obviously brings up the memory of his 10-4 that you commentated on. I think Muku has accidentally cut off the end of your question here, Ian. So let me just find it on my phone. New Zealand went on to lose that game after his heroics. Tenfers are obviously nearly as rare as hen's teeth, but what are the most noticeable bowling achievements in losing causes you can think of? I always remember there was a really good spell that Ryan Harris bowled in a game that came in a losing performance. I think it was up in Durham. I think he went with short pitch bowling, and we hadn't really seen him do that much in Test cricket by that stage because there wasn't really a lot left of him by that point. So I mean, that is certainly one that I remember as just off the top of my head. I'm trying to think if there's anything else dramatic I can think of. Ajaz Patel has, I know he has the most wickets ever in a losing cause. Do you know what? There's a test match where Merv Hughes gets a hat trick at the Whacker. And I reckon he also took a 10 wicket haul. And I'm pretty sure Australia lost in that. Those are the ones off the top of my head. Shane Warne took a 10 wicket haul as well in Sydney. I suppose Jason Crazier's one against India is another one that comes to mind. And if I'm not mistaken, I reckon I covered Chris Woakes taking a 10 wicket haul and losing. I'm trying to think if there's any others there's probably some good single innings ones, right? Where a player has gone absolutely ballistic in one innings, but for whatever reason, still gone on to lose the game. I'm trying to think. Wait, let me. I might be able to bring that up. Actually, I had something similar. The Kapil Dev one. That was the one that I was thinking of. So Kapil Dev takes a 9 for and loses that test match. I certainly won. And then Nathan Lyon, I think, took an 8 for. I was at that test match in the first innings. Took an 8 for in the first innings. Australia went on to lose that one. It's not that common, really. As I said, Ajaz Patel has the most wickets ever in a loss, which is 14. And there aren't really all that many 10-wicket hauls that have come in losses. Because usually they're so important. Oh, there's the full version of Ian's question. Satchmo says, does Australia's win-loss record under Cummins exaggerate how good they have really been, given that they have had more than a few indifferent sessions in that time? They have arguably beaten other teams of similar strengths in the past whose win-loss is inferior. Does Australia's win-loss record under Cummins exaggerate how good they have really been? I don't know how to answer this. One thing I would say is that I've never seen a team that doesn't have indifferent sessions. And I know Australia got obsessed by this. You can actually see it in the Justin Langer documentary. There's the weirdest thing where at one stage their analyst says something along the lines of, oh, you know, we've got to improve in the middle session. And I was thinking, well, okay, everyone does. Like, the middle session is usually a bit of shit show, especially if you're bowling. And I was assuming he was talking about bowling at that stage. The ball doesn't do as much, right? If the sun is out in most parts of the country, it's not going to, it's going to tire your bowlers quicker. We generally don't see movement for whatever reason at that stage, whether it's just because it's drier in the middle of the day than it is at the morning and the evenings. I don't know, but all these sorts of things. So I don't know how to answer that, Satchmo. I think they're a pretty good team. They've been a pretty good test team, and I'm assuming you're talking about test team here, over a four-year period, and they've continued to be that. They've continued to be that. It might change now, but if you've got a spinner who is pretty consistent and three seam bowlers who are, obviously top-class bowlers with, Scott Boland in the wings and that sort of thing. You're gonna and now with bowling all-rounders, well, batting all-rounders who can chip in as well, and someone like Travis Head, like, you're going to be a good team. I just don't know how to answer a question like that, because the West Indies had indifferent sessions, and the Great Australian Cricket Team had indifferent sessions. So I don't know how. I really don't know how to do that. To talk about that. Will says, do you think people overrate the prestige of India in the eyes of domestic fans of other nations? I know the Indian television market makes hosting India incredibly lucrative, but I don't feel like they attract the same type of buzz that, say, England touring tends to generate due to the large number of away fans that follow them and the fact that everyone grew up hating England. I don't know why you think that matters, Will, because your other comment makes the most sense. I know that the Indian television market makes hosting India incredibly lucrative. So what should you have slightly more excited fan base but make less money? That's essentially what you're saying, right? I think India is sort of, they're not quite in that Australia or England bracket at the moment of excitement for, home fans. But they do also bring a lot of Indians to the games. I know what you're saying is they don't bring a lot of touring Indians, right? Which is true. It's starting to happen with India. We are certainly starting to see, middle-class Indians traveling around with the team a little bit more, but not the way that the Barmy Army has been doing it for the last 40 years, right? Or 30 years. And Australia has tour groups, but again, outside of the Ashes, they're not particularly big. But what you do see with India is, no matter where you turn up, there are Indians, because there are so many Indians in the world and, NRI Indians around places that they do turn up. And so you generally get better crowds when India plays some anyway. But what you don't get is the big pack of them the way that you're describing, which is the way the England fans generally go on tours, whereas the Indian fans, if they travel somewhere, generally just do it themselves. So it is a completely different setup. But yeah, it just doesn't matter. Like, what? Okay, so there's no cricket board on earth that would choose to play England over India. There are tourism boards who would choose to play England over India, but no cricket board because you're just going to make more money. So I don't really, I suppose you're right, but I don't really know what the point of it is. Like, quite clearly, you would pick the thing that is going to make you more money. That is pretty much how capitalism works, if I'm not mistaken. Vivek says, predictions on whether the baseball approach, looking to put pressure on the bowling team, shuffling within the crease, would fare better against Ashwin, Jadeja and Akshar than the Aussie batters grinding it out approach last year. Well, you can't really shuffle around the crease to Akshar, Ashwin and Jadeja because you'd be stumped, right? Look, I think there will be times when the Indian bowlers will have pressure put back on them. But because they are so senior, I just find it hard to believe that it's ever going to, I don't know, break them the wrong way. But you know what I mean? Maybe if we see slightly flatter pitches, baseball could come back into it. But I think some of the wickets we've seen in India, I just don't know how that's possible to be able to do that. We did see a test where Zach Crawley made some runs against India in India, where I suppose you could see that an England might point towards that as something that they should do. But you can't really sweep Akshar Patel, right? You can't really come down the wicket to Jadeja, and Ashwin's Ashwin. I'm not sure what you can do to make those three feel uncomfortable consistently. With Bumrah's fit as well, you know, you can move around a little bit and bother him, but he's probably still going to have a reverse spell one day that is going to cause you problems. I'm fascinated to see how it will work. It worked weirdly. It's been inconsistent for a little while, right? Like, I think we've forgotten the fact that, you know, they didn't win that New Zealand series. They didn't win the Ashes. It's not as dominant as it looked to begin with. Teams are starting to work it out a little bit more and understand it. And Australia came up with some good theories against it and some bad theories against it. But I think that really you're looking at playing cricket to the extreme, and those Indian wickets are kind of already at the extreme. Nabil says, you spoke previously about how the Invincibles wouldn't stand a chance today, implying a great deal of innovation has occurred. Who do you think has had a greater impact, players or organisers? Updating laws, implementing ODIs, etc. And based on that, how good would Brabham be today? Well, Nabil, I've done a video on that. Look, he definitely wouldn't average 91.94. He would struggle with the pace of the bowlers. He would struggle with the bounce of the bowlers. There weren't 6'8" guys bowling at 90 miles an hour or even 85 miles an hour when Don Bradman played. Part of that is also the back foot no ball law. So when you talk about whether it's the players or the organisers, that's an organising thing. ODI cricket has obviously changed things, but the world has changed, right? That professionalism. Bradman was, quite often playing against amateurs, almost exclusively against amateurs, and also played some of them after world wars. And, you know, South Africa didn't have any money. And New Zealand didn't have any money. Like, Bradman played against New Zealand, but, you know, India didn't have any money. So it was very hard for those cricketers to develop the way they have. But physically, if you took a 1948 batter of any of the great batters and put them in today, how would they face Kyle Jameson, right? How would they face Marco Jansen? These are just things they never had to worry about. Right? There weren't that many tall bowlers. They didn't bowl at this pace. They weren't left arm bowlers at that pace or that height either, right? There was one good left arm bowler in the early part of cricket and he's got a bowling average of 20, right? Alan Davidson. Now there's hundreds of them. You would have to work all that out. So if you hadn't done that, the organisers have played a small part, but society's probably played the largest part, right? Like, things just keep going forward over and over again. And things have developed. Virat Kohli exists because Bradman existed, right? Kevin Peterson existed because Trumper existed. That doesn't mean that you can put Trumper in the modern game, right? And all of these guys bat because of W.G. Grace, right? He invented the template of modern batting, right? But he'd be rubbish if he played today. And I think that's fine because that's what sport is supposed to be, right? Things move on. The bowlers have got faster. We have the spinners have got faster. There are more revolutions put on the ball. People hit the ball harder. People run between the wicket more. There's better fielding. All these sorts of things. Cricket has changed massively. And so, the old cricketers would struggle. Doesn't mean that they're not great because they can't do the things that haven't occurred yet, right? So, you know, in Bradman's case, he's playing against people bowling with the back foot no ball law. So generally he had to face swing a lot more and a lower arm action, right? So how would he do someone who is not collapsing at the crease to try and get a low arm action to swing the ball around corners and now has to face, you know, Joel Garner or, you know, Kyle Jameson or, you know, any of the, you know, Ollie Robinson, these guys with these huge release points that just have never existed before, right? And if they did, it was one or two. We go on and on about Joel Garner being massively tall. There's like 30 bowlers of his height now. Sandip says, how was your Christmas break? What did you do? What did I do? I didn't really have a Christmas break, Sandip. You know, I suppose the break I had was how short the two test matches were. India, South Africa, you know, I booked myself in for 10 days of work and I did not have to work for 10 days. Christmas, I had sort of two Christmas dinners. We have one big one with my wife's extended family and then we had one at home. They were both very, very good. I'm trying to think if I got anything crickety for Christmas that anyone would care about. I can't even remember what I got. I can't remember. Maybe I did. Those sorts of things do tend to happen. I got a really nice new pair of Nike SBs, which I was happy about. But, you know, look, it's, you know, I'm not a Christian, so Christmas is a thing that happens to me rather than me being involved with. But I love my family and enjoy seeing my family, so that's always a good thing. David says, so I've been wondering what it means that there are so many leagues popping up around the world. Is it just a bubble that will burst? Are these leagues really profitable? For example, I heard tickets to the SA20 were crazy cheap. Yeah, most of these leagues, they don't make your profit, David. You know, the Big Bash makes a slight profit. I think the 100 is still losing money. CPL is obviously being run by an independent company, so they're treading water. But, you know, it's not massively profitable. PSL hasn't probably maximized the money it could make. The BPL is not making money. What a lot of them are doing is not making massive losses or making slight wins. And it's also a lot more consistent than the money they were making before. But no one's getting rich about it. I've talked about it before. It doesn't really make sense. These smaller leagues that pop up, they just don't make any money and then disappear. I wonder how many of them are about dark money and, you know, illegal stuff and all sorts of things, because it doesn't make sense that a lot of these leagues exist. No one seems to watch any of them. I think the most successful T20 leagues in the last couple of years have been the veterans leagues. They seem to make a little bit of money and, you know, guaranteed viewers in India in a way that most of these other leagues don't. And most of these other leagues are, as you said, you know, ticket prices. I mean, I don't think ticket prices matter that much for the SA20, just because ticket prices to South African games are pretty cheap anyway. But it really is about, you know, how you can maximize your revenue via TV and streaming and sponsorship and everything else. And I'd be surprised if any league outside the IPL is making. And maybe one of those, one or two, I don't know if it's Road Safety or the other one, but I know one of them did okay, is making serious money. I would say that almost every other league in the world is probably not making serious money. And it's probably running hand to mouth, hand to mouth with a very small profit and maybe a consistent profit. And a lot of them are soaking up costs because they think eventually one day they will be profitable, and cricket boards are taking risks on them. But no, there's way too many leagues. A whole bunch of them should be amalgamated. I've said this before. Stupid idea. Everyone thought it was their way of printing money, and I've seen no money printed. Christopher says, do you believe there is anything that the average fan could do to save Test cricket? So I get asked this a lot, obviously, after making my film. I mean, the simplest thing is watching it, right? The more people who watch it, the better. The more people who tweet about it, you know, the more people who are engaged with it, certainly, you know, buy tickets to it. It certainly helps. What cricket really needs is a global fan-led collective. Probably three different ones, you could argue, for each different format. But we don't even have a global union. You know, there's quite a few cricket nations who are not involved in different union, who are not involved in the main cricket union. So if there was a really strong global fan body, that could help, but that's not really the average fan, is it? Really, all the average fan can do is keep watching it. I mean, Test cricket exists because we're watching it, right? Even ODI cricket, which at the moment is in the most danger of disappearing, exists because we're watching it, right? If we get annoyed at things and we turn off the TV, that is when it will disappear. And that's the truth, right? There is no other, for an average fan, there is no other thing. That is what needs to happen. That is the end of the chats from Patreon. Some really good questions in there. I will have a quick break here. And then after the break, we will come back and we will do, and I'll see if there's anything in the chat. I'm Jared Kimber and this is Wagon Wheel. Remember that cricket is a funny game. 100 years before we protected our heads, players looked after their groins. So don't be as stupid as old cricketers and protect your computer today. NordVPN is the protection I use when facing cyber shortfalls or when rights issues try to dismiss me. NordVPN will help you get through the straight bat of any geo blocks so you can watch all the cricket you want. If you need your pitch changed, well, NordVPN can doctor any surface to a new location so that your IP address is set up for you to win. Want to buy an associate cricket shirt from a place that won't ship to your country? Select NordVPN. Want to watch a game on a free stream in another hemisphere? NordVPN. Or if you just want to watch a clip on social media that a cricket board won't allow you to, promote NordVPN to pinch it for you. So if you need a VPN, go Nord. Use nordvpn.com/Kimber to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan, plus 4 additional months for free. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. The link is in the show notes. Protect your computer like a cricketer protects its nether region with NordVPN today.
Okay, I don't have many time. I've got no super chats, but I've got a couple of quick. Someone keeps calling me, so I might have to leave very, very quickly. But 1 second, I've just realized I've left a previous question up. There's a couple of interesting ones here. Ben says, do bowlers have a smaller margin for error against taller or shorter batters?
Yeah, I think what it does is you can't bowl your normal length, right? And we are talking about freakishly tall and freakishly small players because, you know, most players are, there's no like average, well, there is an average height, but you know what I mean? That, you know, it has to be someone who's quite extreme. But if you do have a player who is 5'2" or 5'3", or you have a batter who's 6'4", or, you know, has a long stride or something, you know, there will be certainly in those sorts of situations, you struggle with your length a little bit more. I think that's absolutely fine, like a normal thing. And if you've ever bowled to those sorts of players, especially more as a seam bowler, I think you'll understand what I mean. But if you're a spinner and you bowl to a very tall player, you realize that you really have to quite quickly adjust your length to them. I think that's probably fair. I don't know if it's a smaller margin for error. I just think you need to change what you are doing. Arco says, I heard Wasim and Waka say they used to bowl 150 regularly. Was that actually true? Or is the past fast bowlers being legendary fast is another myth? Common Sense says, we have better athletes now. Yeah, we have better athletes now. Look, I don't want to say that these two guys never bowled 150. I think Waka definitely did. And I think Wasim certainly bowled around that speed on occasion as well. Regularly, I find that hard to believe. And I watch them. And I watch them both in their peaks. But There is a reason why Waka Yunus was so good. And I think a big part of that was his extra speed. And so I do think he was probably one of the faster bowlers in the world for a long period of time. And he probably was over 90 miles an hour regularly. But he was probably, you know, when you look at the speed guns, when the speed guns turned up, they were also under 90 miles an hour a lot, right? And in some cases, quite significantly under 90 miles an hour. And when Shoaib turned up, he just looked a little bit quicker than either of those guys had. Right? And we know that he was 150 regularly. So could they touch it? Yes. I mean, I think Michael Holding could bowl very fast, but I also think now there are probably 50 bowlers in the world at the moment who could bowl at his speed. That doesn't mean, and when old players hear this, they get really angry and they're like, oh, you say Michael Holding was fast. I'm like, no. If Michael Holding was in the top 5 fastest in the world at that time, he was fast, right? Fred Spofforth was fast, right? Tom Richardson was fast. But I could face both of those guys in my backyard now, right? Off their full runs, on a dodgy surface, right? What has changed is that there are more bowlers and more consistency, and more professionalism. I think there's been tests that say that Jesse Owens and I can't remember who it was, but one of the modern sprinters might have been Usain Bolt were not actually that much different in speed, but what a difference is the quality of the tracks, the quality of the shoes, and everything else is what it had changed a little bit, right? Those are the things that had changed that had made the bigger difference rather than anything else. Exactly the same now. It makes more sense to bowl fast now than it did in previous generations. In previous generations, you got more assistance off the pitch, right? You didn't need to come in. We learn a lot about the science and the mechanics and dietary and everything else. So certainly we have much more fast bowlers now. Darth Vader says, what is your take on Kartikeya's insistence that big match mentality is a concept? I'm assuming he would think that it is not a concept. The best players perform the best because they are the best players. Are there certain players that are suited to certain times of a game which make them look like they're better players? So, for instance, was Michael Bevan really a more clutch player than Ricky Ponting? Well, how could we tell that? Michael Bevan's position put him in a clutch situation. So, enter the big moment was, well, no, it's not. They've lost four wickets. He's come out to bat. He's going to be batting near the 50th over. So he's going to be involved with a lot of wins because he's an above average number six. The same as MS Dhoni, right? Well, how does that make MS Dhoni or Michael Bevan more clutch than an opener, right? And then the big game thing, well, if you're consistently better than everyone else in all the other games, you're going to be consistently better than other people in the big games. I do think there are certain skills, you know, if you look, you know, the two sports that I watch the most are cricket and basketball. There are certain skills in basketball, like the ability to be able to create your own shot at the end of a game is a very handy skill to have when the defense is suddenly swarming, right? And your ability to separate from the defense for a moment allows you to be more useful at the end of the game than someone else who needs the whole five plays to be moving correctly for them to be open in the corner. And that may not happen as well when the other team's, you know, madly defending. So things like that really, really help, right? At the end of a game, if you're a bowler who has a very good slow ball and a very good Yorker, you're probably going to do pretty well in games where you've got to bowl the last over, right? You know, and you'll be seen as more of a clutch player, so, or a big game player because of that. But we'll have forgotten that the other player did really, really well. Maybe you know, finals or big games and everything else are played at a different tempo. What if that tempo helps you? Right? What is it about Ben Stokes that is helped by the fact that he has to bat in a different way, right? So we go, oh, it's a big game. God, look, he's, you know, he's the man, blah, blah, blah. But it's like, actually, there are technical reasons why Ben Stokes is really good at batting in those. And you can see them, right? The same as we saw with Aidan Markram the other day. What defines a big game, right? Sometimes a big game is looked at retrospectively because someone did a really good performance is the other thing. There's no player who isn't above average consistently who I would say is a big match player. Like, for instance, Kevin O'Brien is the only player I can think of in cricket that would fit this kind of description. But Ireland have actually had tons of big games where he hasn't stepped up. But a couple of the ones that have been broadcast, he has, right? Maybe that's just dumb luck. My guess is it probably is, right? And Kevin O'Brien is a player that in certain situations, I think what we're seeing of Kevin O'Brien is in certain situations when the team is falling apart around him, he concentrated harder. Whereas in those other times when he went out there, he was probably sent out there to be the biffer and probably batted in that way. And maybe I didn't think about it as much. Then we see those games and they're broadcast. And so he has big game mentality. The best players are the best players in a small game or a big game. It's just nonsense. And there are individual players whose skills make them look like they are better, and we get to see them in a very small sample size. My guess is any player in the world, if you looked at whether they're a big game player or not, what you're really saying is that they were very, very good in the games that you saw, right? Or in a small handful of games. And when you start to expand it out, there's almost always a technical reason or a skill-based reason why players perform well. There are some players who prefer to play on TV, right, you know, or in front of big crowds. And I think there is some scientific evidence to suggest that that is a thing. But again, that is more that it gets them focusing a little bit more. It's not that there are a better personality than another player, right? And I think the minute we start talking about big match mentality, we're talking shit, right? We're talking about small sample sizes and our memories over everything else. Anyway, that's it for me today. Thank you very much to everyone for popping in. And I will see you all again next time. I am Jared Kimber, and this was The Wagon Wheel.
Thank you for listening. This podcast has an ad-free version via Patreon, where there are also many other extras as well, including a Discord channel where you can chat to me directly. There is a link to the Patreon in the show notes. We are an independent podcast, so support us any way you can. Maybe give us a review, subscribe, or share on social media. All of these things help us. And when it comes to podcasts, word of mouth is always the best way of making it grow. If we had a guest on, chances are their socials are in the show notes. Please support everyone who comes on this show. I am Jared Kimber, and this is my network. But we also have hosts and co-hosts like Bairam Kazi and Estelle Vasudevan. This network is overseen by Nick McCorriston, and each episode is produced by Ishit Kaburka at Sound Potion Studio. Mukunda Bandredi, or Muku as most people will know, is the head of our YouTube channels, and he also helps out with so many other things like the podcast recordings. And there's so many other people we could thank here, but I just want to thank all the listeners and all the people who help behind the scenes that make this podcast work.